All right, there's a killer aboard this ship, and we got to get him. Now, you boys get over on the starboard side. Grab onto something. Anything! But don't take any chances.
I
see what you can do for him, Doc.
Right, sir.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And I'm happy to bring to you the internationally known writer, artist, editor, musician, cartoonist, grief counselor, and I think Michael H. Price even does some light hauling. Michael, how are you doing?
Yes, I, of course. I'd forgotten about that sideline. Glad to be here. Well, what's up?
Glad to be here, too, to talk about Terror Aboard. You know, you and I are both fans of that pre-code, that pre-1934 Paramount stuff. Murders in the Zoo, of course, Island of Lost Souls.
Island of Lost Souls.
And this, yes. I believe, is maybe the most obscure one of the bunch.
It's pretty close to most obscure. I got an email today from an enthusiast who follows this act on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
I had announced we were getting ready to record, and enthusiast writes in and says, "Man, it took me a lot of doing to find this Terror Aboard, but I finally found it, and it was worth every minute of waiting."
I think he's
like,
probably.
Wow, I love it when somebody finds something they never expected to see and then finds it's not only worth their time but also exceeds their expectations.
Well, let me go ahead and do a quick synopsis. and you're really not giving anything away when you talk about the plot line, because it's pretty evident early on that Maximilian Krieg, as played by John Halliday, who... this day and age, we would call him a one percenter, Michael.
Oh, yes.
One of the one percenters is out there on his yacht, and for reasons that if people want to see the movie, they can. For actually, it's as goofy as it is, there's a certain strange logic in it. He decides he's got a bunch of people on his yacht, which actually looks more like a minesweeper to me, but he's got a lot of people on his yacht, and he wants to abscond to an island with the most beautiful woman on the cruise, Shirley Gray, because if he goes back and docks, he's going to be caught by the authorities because he's been doing some very shady business things. And so he proceeds to knock off everybody on the cruise.
Yeah, and out of mainly, I think, embarrassment. I mean, why? Certainly, Inspector, you must be joking. and of course, the first murder involves the radio man who had taken the incriminating telegram.
That's right.
So it's like he's not really covering his tracks, but he just, well, then how do you resolve this crisis? Oh, I know, I'll just kill everybody.
And it kind of becomes just easier for him because he is completely amoral, and he's a rich, amoral character. Go figure.
But an aristocratic.
Yes.
I don't think Lionel Atwill could have handled this role better.
Well, the ideal situation would be if the boat never docked at all.
Well, that's a pretty tall order, sir.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say it was impossible. A determined man in a desperate situation might destroy a boat. Every living soul on board.
Now, You know, John Halliday is a pretty underrated guy. He really does a good job.
He's regal. He's aristocratic. Mm-hmm. I mean, Atwell, of course, would have done it right.
Mm-hmm.
It's so nice to see a different face in that kind of role, though.
It is. And, you know, one of the things as we get into this, one of the things about it is it's essentially told in a flashback because the ship, in a very creepy sequence, the ghost ship is seen early on floating outside another ship. And when the crew from that ship boards it and finds ostensibly everybody on the ship dead, then it goes and kind of goes into the flashback. But one of the things that really baffles me, and perhaps you can explain it, mm-hmm. Charlie Ruggles, I believe, gets top billing in what is essentially a second banana comedy role. Now, was he not, of course, he's in Murders in the Zoo, and he's in a lot of stuff, Paramount.
Yes,
was he not
usually
a huge...
the comedy relief, if not the leading man.
Yeah.
But Ruggles was a very important ticket seller for Paramount.
See, that's my question. So he was really, even though this is a basically a second banana comedy role,
mm-hmm.
he still gets first billing, and that's why?
That's why. He was the most. He was one of the most marketable talents alongside Charles Laughton.
I did not know
that. Paramount had.
So he played a lot of leading men, too.
Played a lot of leading men, but he always put that comic edge on it. I've seen him play it straight, but I've never seen him without that lighthearted, genial air, and there's a lot of censor bait in Ruggles' performance.
Oh, my
too.
Goodness.
You know, he makes these remarks about putting one's trousers on inside out and then asks the lady if she'd ever done that, and it's like, that's pretty naive and innocent, but in 1933, that was censor bait.
Well, so was his the very end of Murders in the Zoo, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
When you think about when they're basically referring to, I guess, what would we say, an accident that he had because he was frightened. So I wondered
exactly.
about that.
But Ruggles, of course, and I think the great showcase for Charlie Ruggles is, of course, Ruggles of Red Gap.
Mm-hmm.
Contrary to what it might sound like, he doesn't have the title role. He plays a new rich American who acquires an English butler mm-hmm. named Ruggles.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Ruggles is played by Charles Laughton, who's perfect casting.
So both of those guys were contract players at the time.
They were big talents for Paramount. And, of course, the two major Paramount shockers of the early Depression years, Murders in the Zoo and Island of Lost Souls, were both showcases by turns for Ruggles and Laughton.
Right, right. So about how long did Ruggles last as a box office draw?
Right up into the television era. He had the
really?
Charlie Ruggles show on network television in the early 1950s.
Well, is this then, this cast, unlike Murders, well, unlike certainly Island of Lost Souls because of mm-hmm. Laughton, is this essentially, would you say, a B-picture cast?
It's a... barring Ruggles.
Mm-hmm. Everybody else, Neil Hamilton, Jack LaRue, Shirley Grave,
oh, yeah.
and Ray Teasdale.
Headed for Poverty Row, straight
yes.
from the big studio B unit.
Many of them were, weren't they? Many of this cast did end up making their biggest marks. I know Shirley Gray did seems like she did a ton of like Chesterfield stuff. You
mm-hmm.
know, back in
Jack
the
LaRue, the mm-hmm. quintessential Poverty Row gangster figure.
Right.
Neil Hamilton, of course, the heroic detective of many a low-budget potboiler.
Yes, yes, and of course, we might also add Inspector or Commissioner Gordon in
Commissioner
the Batman
Gordon
TV
to be,
series.
Yes.
Catastrophic. Unprecedented. Batman and Robin not available. You know what this means, don't you?
If you're thinking what I'm afraid you're thinking...
Precisely, Chief O'Hara. The moment we've dreaded for years has arrived. This time, we're going to have to solve a case ourselves.
And it's lovely to see these artists at that stage of their career, and even lovelier to see Halliday doing it. John Halliday doing this great bad guy leading man role. Not too many years removed from, in fact, less than a decade away from his retirement.
Oh, really? Because he did way back to the silence.
Early silence. He retired in 41.
Mm-hmm. That would make 30 years then.
And he was approaching, well, early 60s at the time.
Yeah, he was born in 1880, and his first film was made in 1911. So he spent 30 years in the business. That's a pretty good career. Yeah,
that's a good stretch and a wonderful talent. Always played that the Atwell type role, which ranged from sympathetic to not sympathetic.
That's right.
And what's weird, he had that beautiful Oxford accent, but he was straight out of Brooklyn.
Yeah, and in this he really is very believable. Again, I think people who are concerned about the class wars, or whatever you want to call it, of modern day class things that are going on, will find kind of a lot to that resonates with what's going on now.
It is this kind of predatory fat cat behavior that, for one thing, provoked Eugene Debs to run for president.
Exactly, at that same time.
Approximately that space in time, it was shirt sleeves audiences, to mm-hmm. use Variety's term,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that working class movie going audience of the Depression liked escape,
and they liked to see rich people get their comeuppance.
And one of their forms of escape, not to mention the newly departed and sorely missed Shirley Temple,
yes.
There was light romance, musical comedy, slapstick galore, and love swells get their comeuppance.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
But of course, getting to see them misbehave and deserve their comeuppance.
Which, and I tell you, Halliday's character certainly does. Nobody deserves it more.
You don't find a predatory aristocrat quite more ferocious than this Maximilian Krieg. It's funny, the picture, 1933. It's interesting that the yacht has set sail on a Friday the 13th.
Right, right. Yeah.
And interesting to note that. Apart from the civilized veneer and the utterly polite upper crust mannerisms of all these doomed passengers and their predatory host, this could be a Jason at camp situation.
Yes, very, just people in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yes, and
yeah.
So once again we find there's really nothing new. The same objections to CEO perks and abuses, the dovetailing of these modern day concerns with ruling class abuses.
Yes.
The fabled 1% that mm-hmm. That has become the trendy buzzword.
Right.
Nothing new. This is all happening.
Which
is a microcosm. The same kind of world depicted, say, in a monogram of this same period,
mm-hmm.
the 13th Guest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who's causing all this mischief? Who's causing all these people to wind up electrocuted and positioned at an abandoned banquet table like a tableau? Well, somebody from the ruling class is the murderer.
I think that's interesting.
The audience is that working class audience that kept the movies so thoroughly well populated at a nickel to 15 cents a seat in the Depression years, they loved to watch this sort of activity.
And, you know, I guess the Gilded Age wasn't that far back in the rearview mirror, was it?
No.
You know, 10 years, maybe?
Yes, we had been... We'd been cavaliers, and now all of a sudden we were roundheads again. And when you're a cavalier, you want to be a roundhead.
That's
when you're a roundhead, you wish you were a cavalier. So it never stops. It's a vicious cycle.
It is.
But
but
what a splendid rediscovery this film is.
It is, and you know, it's interesting. We were talking about how far back John Halliday's career went. Paul Sloan, the director, you know, he went back to a film called The Cossack Whip back in 1916 was his first
mm-hmm.
picture. And his career kind of petered out in the late 1930s. So interestingly enough, have you ever seen the little noir he did, The Sun Sets at Dawn for Eagle Lion?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that was, he produced it, he wrote it, he directed it. But he really wasn't known for darker material. I mean, he did Half Shot at Sunrise, Wheeler and Woolsey in 1930.
So, can you keep a secret if she helps you?
Oh, sure.
Well, we're in the Secret Service.
Yes?
Yes, you see, there's so many spies around. You know, German spies, Austrian spies, Bulgarian spies.
Ooh. An Eskimo spy.
comical, very comical.
Oh, do you know Colonel Marshall?
Do we know Colonel
Isn't
Marshall?
Isn't she the sill?
Say, do you know that Colonel Marshall thinks so much of us that he gives our photographs to every soldier under his command?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Especially the MPs.
Yeah.
Well, he's a very good friend of mine. He comes here to this restaurant every day.
Here?
Yes.
Well, so long, girl.
So he was, I guess, you know, just a studio director that took whatever assignment was handed to him, I would imagine.
And handled it with style and panache and quite an accomplishment here.
It was.
I don't know when I've enjoyed discovering, well, I'll tell you when I've enjoyed discovering a Depression-era picture as much or more, and that was Arcade. 13 Women.
13 Women, you were talking about. That's an RKO film, right? Yeah.
Very similarly ruthless story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
RKO and, you know, Universal made grim pictures, but Universal always had that reassuring quality. Everything's going to be all right until the next crisis.
Order is restored, as you've often said to me.
Order is restored.
Yeah.
But at the Paramount Pictures and the RKO pictures of the same period, you find the studio less willing to send you away feeling reassured.
Oh, listen, that Paramount stuff is grim.
Yeah.
Now, that's some grim stuff. Couple more things. Did it strike you, with Shirley Gray being in this, that she did almost the same sort of picture with a few years later with Bela Lugosi for Hammer and Mystery of the Marie Celeste?
Mystery of the Marie Celeste, yes.
Or I guess it was also called Phantom Ship, wasn't it? Yeah.
Phantom Ship was the more generally distributed title, mm-hmm.
About that. That's somebody wiping out crew members on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it just struck me that, I think the similarity ends there, and I don't want to read more into it than there is, but it's interesting to me that a couple of her pictures had shipboard murders. And then there's Varee Teasdale, and who was I thought she was a silent picture star, but she really wasn't. She just looked older than she really was.
That was a case of probably overdoing it on stage and then trying to make a second career in film. She was typecast as early as the 20s as the interloper.
The other woman.
The other woman, yes.
A society other woman, usually.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Usually yeah. Of society, probably the matron trying to pretend she's not.
Exactly. Perfect, yeah. She's very good in this,
very
though.
Strong presence. It's she was bound for retirement soon as well, and why didn't they give her better roles? Well, because she was great in the roles they gave her.
And then, of course, she married Adolphe Menjou and did the radio show with him that was
mm-hmm.
late 40s, I guess into the 50s, actually.
What so a great she, voice, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, she yeah. had a terrific voice. Well, I would definitely, for folks who enjoy that Paramount, and there is a certain Paramount feeling to this. It's a very edgy feeling, and it's a very very dark feeling. I mean, this is compared to the Universals, as you were saying. These are some grim, dark pictures, this little triptych that Paramount did in the early
30s. Well, remember how grim and dark a lot of the Paramount comedies are from the same period.
That's a good point.
I mean, there's really not a grimmer or darker film than The Man on the Flying Trapeze.
Good point. Very good point.
W.C. Fields' secret autobiography. He was really feeling sorry for himself when he made that picture, and it comes through.
Well, let's plug our stuff in the couple minutes we've got left. What do you got going on lately?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're just on the point of publishing the new comics anthology, Dead Unburied.
Mm-hmm.
New entry in the Comics from the Gone World series.
Excellent.
And ooh-wee, does it look good.
Oh, man, I can't recommend those enough. That's for those who love their 50s horror comics with a big dose of Dada, that's what you want. No,
that may be a minority audience, you know, but we keep on keeping. We've been actually there's a lot of action for the Comics from the Gone World series on this, on one of our companion Facebook pages, Horror Comics 1950s and Beyond, which is run by a friend named Craig Yeo in the publishing business.
Oh, sure, I know Craig.
You know Craig's
Absolutely,
work, and
yeah.
And so we've been swapping ideas and materials back and forth. There's a fellow from England named Jason Crawley who's now publishing a really nice anthology of gothics called The Bloke's Terrible Tomb of Terror. And I swear it looks like an Archie Goodwin creepy.
Oh, nice. Very nice. And that comes from one who worked for Archie Goodwin at Erie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, back in 70, the first two scripts I think I sold to Warren were Archie Goodwin was the editor. What a wonderful guy he was.
Wonderful guy. Very encouraging and not the least bit insecure or jealous of his fellow authors.
No, and you know, we were veterans of, and we should say something also, I guess, about Larry Lankford, who put on all of the Dallas conventions, the fantasy fairs and the fantasy festivals for many years, where you and I met, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
Back in the 80s, who were sad to have to report, who has passed on. And, you know, he did a lot to help us, those of us, especially, I think, in this part of the country, but really from all over. You know, he brought in Archie Goodwin. He brought in Robert Crumb. He brought in so many different people to these conventions, and it's a big loss to have lost.
A terrible loss, and I find I went to a small SF convention a few weeks ago in Louisville, Texas, and I'll be darned. I was expecting, you know, high concept, pitch, that sort of thing. A lot of installations and featured attractions and hype. It felt like an early Lankford show.
Wonderful.
I was delighted, and I got to meet Felix Silla.
Oh, yes.
The dwarf actor.
Yes.
Whom we mentioned in Forgotten Horrors to the Nth Degree.
Manitou, was that? No, it was Manitou his film?
I'm thinking of She-Freak.
She-Freak, of course. Yes.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. Our friend Dave Friedman's picture. Homage to Freaks, of course. Well, all right. Now that we want to get back on the plugs also, and we want to say that we're getting some robust sales. I'm very happy to see Forgotten Horrors doing well.
The new Forgotten Horrors books and the revised older books are doing very nicely, and all thanks to the same bunch that seems to dig this Forgotten Horrors podcast. That's why we do it. That's why we make this stuff, because we're trying to make books and programs that would please us if we were coming to them cold.
Exactly.
And I learned a long time ago that if you write to please yourself, you're probably going to please a whole lot of other people.
That's right, and we can't thank the folks enough. Joey Hambrick, our producer, tells us that we have over 150 people on our... what is that called, Joey?
They're subscribers.
To the podcast.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is terrific. We're very happy to have you guys aboard, guys and girls, we're hoping. maybe just guys, we don't know. I would like to say also that I have a new website, the Reverse Karma Press website.
Excellent.
And we're selling a couple of things through that, including, and we've done really well. I was very surprised. We did really well with our pulp reprint book. I wrote a new story for it in the style of Robert Leslie Bell. I'm a Dan Turner Hollywood detective, a Christmas story, which is the first new Dan Turner story in about 60 years. Mm-hmm. And it's done very well. If anybody's interested in... the book is called Hardboiled Christmas Stories. If anybody's interested in that book or old pulp reprints as well as a new story, you can go to the Reverse Karma Press website and check it out. And our friend Joey Hambrick is maintaining that as well for us. Anything else we need to do before we sign off and reconvene here in a few weeks?
I think we've covered the waterfront, which reminds me of another great old Grim Depression era picture.
Boy, is it ever. Ben Lyon and Claudette Colbert and people being drowned in barrels. Indeed. Michael, it's always a pleasure. We're visiting again soon and want to thank everybody for listening. We really appreciate it.
Back with you.